Welcome to episode 242 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com here for Sunday, October 20th, 2012. I am the Solid Monster. Hope everybody's having a good week. I want to give a shout out here at the top of the show to my good buddy Noah Mark. Unfortunately, he is dealing with a family situation right now. He will be unable to join me for Raw this Monday in New Jersey. If you listened to last week's show when he called in, he surprised me with a ticket to Raw as a belated birthday gift, which was very nice of him to do. That is the kind of person he is, always thinking of others, and now we think of him. So we're all sending positive vibes your way, buddy. Here's hoping everything works out for the best. More sad news this week, unfortunately, to lead off with. Mike Graham, the son of the legendary Florida promoter Eddie Graham, took his own life this week. He was found dead by his wife from a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. His father, who was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame back in 2008, an honor that Mike accepted on his dad's behalf, Eddie Graham died the same way, via gunshot to the head after battling alcoholism for a number of years. His son, Mike Graham's son, I believe his name was Steven, also died many years ago after committing suicide. So just a terrible string of tragedies for this family here. No word on what factors may have led him to do this, but whatever the case, a man is dead, cut down by his own hand, and that is the real shame here. My memories of him as a wrestler are honestly few and far between. I know him more for some of the outlandish, ridiculous, Hogan-esque comments he's made about certain things over the years, but now is not the time to dwell on that. So Mike Graham, dead at 61. Let me just say that I apologize if I sound a little bit different this week to some of you. I'm having my own throat issues here, so bear with me. We'll start out with Raw this past Monday night from Nashville, Tennessee. The choice has been made, and it will in fact be the undefeated Ryback putting his streak on the line inside Hell in a Cell 1 week from today, or actually 1 week from tomorrow as I'm recording this on Saturday, against WWE Champion CM Punk. John Cena obviously not healing quick enough from elbow surgery to return for the pay-per-view, and so WWE has decided to go with Plan B. And thankfully for them, Ryback is getting over with the crowd. The Goldberg chants are slowly but surely being replaced by chants of Feed Me More. So now the million-dollar question becomes, what do you do? Who goes over at Hell in a Cell? Can't do a DQ or a countout finish to protect Ryback and keep Punk's reign intact. Can't do that in Hell in a Cell. Something's got to give. Either Punk's reign comes to an end before he makes it to The Rock in January, or Ryback suffers his first loss, however screwy it may end up being. They've booked themselves into a corner with these gimmick pay-per-views, so what do you do? Some people have suggested perhaps having Brock Lesnar interfere and help Punk, a fellow Paul Heyman guy, win the match, maybe leading to a Ryback versus Lesnar match down the road. You could also set up a John Cena Ryback against CM Punk Brock Lesnar tag team main event for Survivor Series. But it doesn't really matter because that ain't going to happen. Lesnar's dates are as limited now as they were when he quit, quote-unquote quit, after SummerSlam. And if they want him for the build-up to WrestleMania, they're not going to waste him on a show like this, so forget that. It's not the right time to take the title off Punk, just like it's not the right time to put the title on Ryback. I wouldn't do it, not yet. I mean, I probably would put the title on Ryback in the near future if he keeps mowing down guys, and if the crowds keep getting behind him, absolutely, you go with your hot hand. I just feel it would be a little too early to do that. Now, you can do a finish in this match where Punk, let's say, escapes the cell, perhaps with some help from Paul Heyman, or perhaps Ryback smashes him through it. However it happens, Punk gets out and basically runs away. I mean, he and Ryback can brawl all over the arena. You can do this big spot maybe where he kills Punk. But basically, you do a finish without ending up back inside the cell. So you don't really have an official finish. The match just kind of ends. Is that a shitty finish? You bet your ass it's a shitty finish. But that's the one thing that they could do to kind of protect both guys if they wanted to go in that direction. Or they can have John Cena interfere in some way and inadvertently cause Ryback the match. So you beat Ryback for the first time, but it's under dubious circumstances. I don't like the idea of beating Ryback yet, but I would much rather Ryback lose one match that's really not going to hurt him in the eyes of the fans than NCM Punk's 330-plus-day title reign prematurely because John Cena got a boo-boo on his elbow and Raw did a 2.5 2 weeks ago. It's got to be a much bigger deal, I think, when Punk loses the title. It's got to be a much bigger deal when it finally happens. And the reality is, you can't send Ryback on the road at this point as the champion to house shows and all that and expect him to have main event quality matches night in and night out. It's just not realistic. I know WWE likes to send the fans home happy. You know, you build up to your main event. John Cena is able to go out there and headline with CM Punk or headline with Dolph Ziggler, and at the house shows, they can have 15, 20-minute matches. I don't think you can do that with Ryback. I just don't get the sense the guy's ready for it. And again, I hate to see him get beat, but it's really not that big of a deal if you book it in such a way where people know the dude got screwed and should have really won. I mean, when WWE beat Brock Lesnar for the first time, I remember being so angry. I was pissed as a fan. I could not believe they had Big Show, of all people, be the person to hand Brock Lesnar his first loss on TV back at the Survivor Series. This was actually a decade ago. 2002. They did the Heyman heel turn, and Show beat him with a choke slam on top of a chair. And I hated that. But you know what? Did it hurt Lesnar in the long run? Was Brock Lesnar any less of a star than he was before Big Show pinned him? Absolutely not. In part, because of how goddamn impressive Lesnar was in the Garden that night. I mean, for Christ's sake, he was throwing a 500-pound man around like a small child with suplexes and hoisting him up on his shoulders for an F5. I mean, that was one for the highlight reel. All they need to do with Ryback next Sunday is make him look strong even in defeat. Make him look dominant. Have one big spot where he just makes people's jaws drop. Something to get over what a beast this guy is. And the finish of the match won't matter. That's what they need to hope for. What they really need to think about is how they even ended up in this position in the first place. How thin must they be on the babyface side of the Raw brand, their flagship show where Ryback is the only logical substitute when John Cena is not able to go? How poorly have they prepared for a future without John Cena where Cena finally gets hurt and the only backup plan is to insert a guy who's just now starting to build some real momentum? You know, Randy Orton is off filming a movie, and he's a SmackDown guy anyway, so you can't plug him in there. Kofi Kingston is not yet at that level, even though he's getting a push. Hopefully he can be one day. Daniel Bryan, you know, he isn't quite back to being a babyface just yet, but I suppose you could have gone with him. You know, it's revisiting an old feud that's already been done, but, you know, plus Bryan's a tag team champion, but at least you know you'd get a hell of a match between him and Punk if you wanted to go in that direction. You know, you've got Kane, although I don't exactly think a Kane-CM Punk main event would light the world on fire at a pay-per-view. My point is, their options are limited, and they have nobody to blame but themselves for it. I mean, maybe the Cena injury will be their wake-up call. You know, John Cena's 35 years old. He's not getting any younger. He won't be around forever. And by the way, neither will CM Punk, who keeps teasing that, you know, 2-3 years from now, he may be retired. Now, a lot of guys have said that before. I still remember Booker T doing an interview once when he was, you know, 10 years younger, saying, I can't see myself wrestling in my, 40s or mid-40s, and yet he was still wrestling. So, I mean, guys say that all the time, but, you know, Punk is another guy who's given an indication he's not going to be around for that much longer. I mean, what would happen if John Cena suffers a career-ending injury and then CM Punk decides to retire? You know, start building up some other people, not just Ryback. Ryback is a start. Ryback, you know, I'm happy to see Ryback finally getting over. You know, maybe he's not the best wrestler in the world, but who cares? The guy, you know, the guy goes in there, he smashes dudes. He gets the fans to chant, feed me more. You can call him Goldberg 2.0 if you want to. I call him money. I think it's great that Ryback is getting over, and he's going to be a champion. But he's only one guy. Let's get two or three more solid players on the babyface side so that when stuff like this happens, you don't need to scramble. So anyway, that's my take on the whole Punk Ryback thing. That was the conclusion of Raw. It was Ryback putting his name on the dotted line. They kind of teased that Vince McMahon would pick perhaps John Cena to challenge Punk at the pay-per-view. And Cena, you know, it's an odd thing because obviously Cena won't be ready in time, and so they kind of had no choice. So they had to come up with a way where they can get Ryback in there. Now, I personally would have think it just would have made more sense to just admit that John Cena is hurt, his doctors won't clear him, and so therefore Vince McMahon will not allow him to wrestle. You know, you have Cena out there going, come on, you know, come on, coach, put me in. I want to go even if I'm not 100%. And Vince says, listen, I can't allow it. It's my company. I say no. The doctors say no. You can't wrestle. You can't wrestle. But yeah, that could go both ways. But the point is, the way they did it is just very bizarre to me. You have John Cena out there who has been talking about how badly he wants to beat Punk. And John Cena always talks about how important the WWE Championship is and how he wants to get that title back. It means everything to him. It means the world to him, blah, blah, blah. And yet, here he is before Vince can even announce his decision. Maybe Vince was going to announce a triple threat match. Maybe he was going to give Cena and Ryback a chance to beat Punk at Hell in a Cell. In fact, I think that would have made even more sense because, you know, Vince McMahon hates this man so much. You've got two men that have a legitimate claim to beating the crap out of CM Punk. Why not make a triple threat match? You know, that way you can hide Cena. Cena doesn't have to do much if he's still hurt. Ryback can still take most of the match with Punk, but you get Cena in there. But that's not the direction they went in. But there's John Cena on TV saying, you know what? I'm going to surrender my possible title shot here because Ryback looks like a guy that can kick Punk's ass. So you know what? I'm going to step aside and give Ryback the title shot. And that's a very noble thing, I suppose, for John Cena to do, but just very bizarre to me because it goes against everything that this guy talks about, you know, as far as how important the championship is and this and that. So I just thought that was a little odd, to say the least. But you know what? They put Ryback over strong at the end of the show. Cena got the fans to start chanting, feed me more, feed me more. And so, you know, now we have somebody other than John Cena in the main event on pay-per-view. I mean, Cena and Punk, to me, they have great matches. I personally would not have minded seeing John Cena against CM Punk one more time if that was it, if that was the climax, if that was the final chapter, so to speak, because they have great chemistry together. John Cena and CM Punk have great matches. But we have somebody fresh in the main event. This is what people wanted. Everybody, myself included, we're always saying, why is it the same people over and over again? Well, we've got somebody different now in the main event. I don't really see there being any room for people to bitch and moan. Maybe the match is going to suck. Maybe the match is going to be great. Maybe the match is going to be 5 minutes long. Maybe they will beat Ryback. Maybe they will end Punk's title reign. That's part of the intrigue, I think, going into this B-show pay-per-view. You really don't know what they're going to do. I don't know that there's any... I don't necessarily know that there's any great finish here. I think it's a lose-lose situation no matter what you do, but at least it's intriguing. I don't know what they're going to do. I can't make a prediction. I mean, I can try to guess, but it's a complete guess job. And it's been a while, I think, since we've been able to say that about a WWE pay-per-view, and who knows, maybe it'll help the buy rate because of it. People will be genuinely intrigued to see Ryback in his first pay-per-view main event. So that's how Raw ended. It's just a couple of other notes on the show. These shows are so long. I can't review them segment by segment anymore. It's just impossible for me to do that. It is worth a mention how much more tolerable Michael Cole is when he is not doing his heel character, his heel shtick on these shows. Just so much better. So much better. Nobody will ever mistake Michael Cole for being the best wrestling announcer of all time. But I always thought Michael Cole was quite good. You know, maybe not great, but he can be very good. And this is when he's very good, when he's doing the typical play-by-play role, because that's what he's there for. Jim Ross, we all know what Jim Ross is capable of, and JR is not the play-by-play guy anymore. But JR, I think, has really hit his stride teaming with Michael Cole. You can say the first week or two, maybe he was a little rusty, and they were talking over each other sometimes, but it's been a couple of weeks now, and I'm actually going to be really sad to see them split JR and Cole up once Jerry Lawler is able to return. Lawler, by the way, made his return this week off air at the SmackDown tapings in Memphis on Tuesday. They have video of his speech up on WWE.com. He praises Michael Cole for being the person who got the wheels in motion to help save his life. He thanked Dr. Michael Sampson, who quite literally saved his life that night. He got a hero's welcome, a very nice moment. It'll be very nice to see him back on Raw, but I stick to what I said on Sound Off 234. With these three-hour shows now, I wish they would do a split crew once Lawler is able to return, where you have some form of Jim Ross and JBL maybe taking the first half of the show, with Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler taking the second half. Or even Cole and JBL, who work very well together, doing the first half, and then you leave the other half to JR and King and put them back together. You know, it's the old Nitro formula of having the different announce teams, and it allows them to keep Ross and JBL on the A show, which is, in my opinion, much better with them on commentary. The show is so much more improved, having the different voices on there, and they're so good at what they do. It would be a shame, you know, when Lawler comes back, as cool a moment as that's going to be, to just see JR and JBL kind of slink off into the sunset and not be heard again. We had another Wade Barrett-Sheamus match. I believe they had one on SmackDown as well, but we had the second one on Raw this week. With another fuck finish, Big Show came out. But, again, I maintain that I think Sheamus and Wade Barrett could very well headline WrestleMania. Maybe not next year, but I could see that as a WrestleMania main event down the road. I think the two of them work well together. There's two big dudes who go in there. They're pretty good wrestlers. You know, they're not the greatest or anything, but Sheamus this year has a tendency to go in there and have great matches with whoever he's in the ring with. You know, him and Del Rio, as goddamn sick and tired of that feud as I got. You know, the fact is they could go in there and have pretty good matches. And in fact, the last match they had, which may have been a Night of Champions, was, I thought, maybe the best of the bunch of the 24 or so that it feels like they had this year. Sheamus had great matches with Daniel Bryan, which is not just Daniel Bryan. You have to have two guys to have a great match, and they had great matches as well. And Sheamus and Barrett, I think, also have a chemistry. So I enjoy watching the two of them go at it. I don't mind having the non-finish, because I'd like to see a real finish between them ultimately. I admit I have not even watched any of SmackDown yet, so it's entirely possible that if they had that match on Friday, that I'm sure it did have a finish. But the point is, on Raw, it did not. And going forward, my hope would be that they will revisit this down the road. They can build Barrett back up a little bit more. He hasn't been back that long, but in the future, this is definitely a match I would not mind seeing again. We had a tag match on Raw Monday night as well. It was a match between Primo and Epico against Team Rhodes Scholars. And the reason we had this match is because Rey Mysterio has been violently ill, apparently. I don't know if it's the flu or what the hell is going on with Rey, but he has been very sick. He was bedridden for several days. It was not a cover story. That is what happened. And there is even some debate as to whether or not he'll be able to compete this Monday night on Raw. They were going to do the match with Team Road Scholars against Rey and Sin Cara this coming Monday instead. And I'm not sure if Rey's going to be ready to go this Monday either. I guess maybe they can delay it until Hell in a Cell if they had to. I think that would be a nice match to see. I'm going to Raw Monday in New Jersey. I would love to see it, so hopefully it happens. So instead, we got Team Road Scholars, the team of Cody Rhodes and Damian Sandow against Primo and Epico. And I like this match. I like this match. The fans may not have liked it because they seemed awfully quiet for most of it. But this was a great kind of old-school tag team wrestling match. You know, they gave it several minutes, and you know, the heels were beaten down on the faces. They did the hot tag, and Primo and Epico are actually very good, obviously. They don't get the kind of credit I think they deserve. And in the end, Team Road Scholars won. They did their little thing at the end of the match where Cody kind of shakes Damian's hand, and then he gives him a nice pull. Damian does his little cartwheel. They've actually gelled very well together. They have a nice little act going for themselves. So I thought that was very cool. We had Kofi Kingston and The Miz as well. Kofi Kingston pinned Miz in a non-title match to build up to the title match that they were going to have on WWE Main Event on Ion on Wednesday night. A match that I didn't even think would take place after Kofi nearly killed Miz on the show with the Trouble in Paradise. I mean, this was the sickest kick you will ever see on a WWE show. Maybe not on a Ring of Honor show or a New Japan show where everybody kicks each other in the face every 5 seconds, but on a WWE show, this is not something you see all the time. He absolutely drilled Miz in the head with his finish to the point where he busted his head open. Miz needed 6 stitches to close the wound above his eye. I thought for sure he was concussed, but apparently he was not, since he wrestled not once but twice at the tapings the very next night. To me, this was the highlight of the show right here. It may have been an accident, obviously it was, and it may not have been as epic as the famous Shawn Michaels super kick on Shelton Benjamin, but this one has got to be way up there. And I am so happy to see them doing something meaningful with Kofi Kingston as a single star again. I talked about how they should be pushing Kofi weeks ago, before they broke him up with R-Truth and they actually started pushing him. And to me, it was just common sense. You've got this mid-card babyface who's very good, and the fans like him. And God knows you need to make more stars on this show. And who else are they going to go to unless they started bringing up more people from developmental? I mean, you've got people like Seth Rollins and Richie Steamboat, and you've got heels as well, Dean Ambrose and Bray Wyatt. There's a lot of talent ready to kind of bubble up and be brought up to the main roster. But Kofi is there. You know what I mean? He's there. He's good. Use him. And I'm really happy to see them finally doing that. He won the Intercontinental Championship on Wednesday night after a fun match with The Miz on Main Event. Main Event is a very good show. I missed it the week prior, but I did watch it this week. Just the format of the show with the announcers in the ring and how they build up the main match. It's an hour long. I mean, for Christ's sake, it's got to be the best WWE show on TV right now simply because it's 60 minutes. I mean, after 3 hours of Raw every week, and by the time you get to that 10 p.m. hour, it's just so goddamn tiring to just sit there and watch the show. I mean, that's the one thing I'm dreading about going to the show on Monday. I'm excited to be going, but at the same time, I'm bringing he's not a non-fan. I'm bringing a friend of mine who at one time was a big wrestling fan. Now he's, a casual fan at best, and I have warned him that these shows are no longer 2 hours. He was not aware of that. And so my hope is that he doesn't lose interest midway through the show. I guess we'll see. But Main Event, very good match between Kofi and Miz. They gave them a lot of time. Just built very well. Kofi nailed him with the kick, pinned him 1-2-3. And for the fourth time, Kofi Kingston is your Intercontinental Champion. They really put it over as something special afterwards. They had Matt Stryker go in the ring to interview him. Kofi did a little promo in the ring and really put over what a big deal this was. And I think the phrase he kept using was like the beast within, the beast has been unleashed. And like I said previously, Kofi can be a big star, face or heel. Yes, I think he can be a good heel as well. And it's just nice to see him not floundering in the tag team ranks anymore. So thumbs up on that. The Divas stopwatch, for those who are interested this week, 4 minutes, 38 seconds. Better than average, with Eve pinning Layla to retain her Divas title. Layla got her foot on the bottom rope before the 3 count, but hey, that's how it goes. I guess we know where the replacement NFL reps ended up. They ended up on Raw. So that was your Divas action for the week. And that's really all I have to say about Raw. Overall, it was an okay show. Just way too much going on. Way too long. We already know this. But for the key stuff on the show, the Ryback stuff and, the important stuff was very good. So maybe in that respect, the show did its job. If it got people interested in Hell in a Cell, then it did what it set out to do. There's advertising for Raw this Monday in New Jersey showing a CM Punk John Cena main event, Lumberjack match. I would imagine that will not be happening. So I believe the match has now been changed to Punk and Ryback. So one of the things, if I stick around long enough to see the dark matches on Monday, is I may be able to see CM Punk versus Ryback before Hell in a Cell, although I would imagine it'll be a quick 2 or 3 minute thing. But that should be interesting. And they're also advertising Big Show and Sheamus in a last man standing match. So I may be getting a pay-per-view card when Raw goes off the air on Monday night. So I will be sure to give a full report on that on next week's Sound Off. Switch gears here to TNA. They had a pay-per-view last weekend. You might have heard about it. Bound for Glory. Their version of WrestleMania. And if Bound for Glory is their version of WrestleMania, I don't know. It doesn't feel quite as special as WrestleMania to me. But I guess you can't really. It's like comparing apples and oranges, really. But Bound for Glory was a pretty good show. I saw most of it. It was from the Grand Canyon University Arena in Phoenix, Arizona. I think they had a crowd of about 3,000 people there. It's just nice whenever TNA gets out of the Impact Zone. And to me, that's one of the things that's killing the brand, I think, is just being in the same place week after week. Sometimes the crowd is hot. Most of the time, they kind of just sit on their hands. And a hot crowd can make all the difference. And the crowd in Phoenix was hot, especially when the show started. You had Rob Van Dam and Zema Ion for the X title. That was one of the few predictions I got wrong on the show. I predicted they would keep the title on Ion. They, in fact, did change it. Rob Van Dam is the new X Division champion. The crowd loved Rob Van Dam. He was, I don't know if it was just the fact that it was the opening match and they saw somebody that was a big star in WWE or what the deal was, but the fans were going nuts for that opening match. I went 6-2, by the way, in my picks, which is pretty good. I would say that's a very good batting average. The only ones I got wrong were I predicted that Miss Tessmacher would retain the Knockouts title, and she lost it to Tara. And again, Rob Van Dam won the X Division title. In fact, by the time this pay-per-view was over, as many people pointed out to me, you had Jeff Hardy as the new TNA World Heavyweight Champion. You had Rob Van Dam as the X Division Champion. You had Chavo Guerrero as one half of the World Tag Team Champions. You had Tara as the new Knockouts Champion. And on top of that, you had D-Von Dudley as the big Aces and Eights reveal in that match. It's just an interesting thing to point out. Not that it was a bad move to put the title on Tara or anything like that. Even Jeff Hardy. Again, Jeff Hardy is probably the biggest star in the company. They want to keep him when his contract expires. They want to make him happy. So I don't even mind Jeff Hardy winning the world title or Tara winning the Knockouts title. I just think it's a bit peculiar when you really look at the champion's roll call. The only real champion, you've got Hernandez as one half of the tag champs. You've got Samoa Joe as the television champion, which is the one shining beacon, I think, because I'm very happy to see them doing something with Samoa Joe. Samoa Joe and Kofi Kingston, you know, when you look at Samoa Joe and Kofi Kingston, you don't really look at those two guys and say, boy, they have a lot in common. You know, Kofi is a high flyer. Samoa Joe is definitely not a high flyer. He can fly. He can soar through the ropes and do topes and shit like that. But Samoa Joe is not known as being a high-flying aerial kind of guy. You know, he's a brawler. He's a submission specialist. And that's what he's known for. And so, again, you look at a Kofi, you look at a Joe. Many differences between the two of them. However, that being said, I look at Kofi Kingston and Samoa Joe as two case studies in both companies. Two guys that at one time were getting a big push. Kofi was never quite pushed to the championship level. But again, go back to 2009, the whole deal with Randy Orton. I was in Madison Square Garden for that show when Kofi did the boom drop on Randy Orton. In fact, Michael Cole brought that up on commentary, I think on Raw Monday night. They actually made reference to the fact that, hey, by the way, for those of you who forgot, at one time, Kofi Kingston was a star. You know, just to remind everybody who may have forgotten about that. Samoa Joe used to be the world champion in TNA. He came in, he was a ball of fire, big star from Ring of Honor, right? He was a big fish in a small pond. Now he comes into, a slightly larger pond, still a pretty small one. And they pushed him great. I remember the build-up to that lockdown match in 2006 between Samoa Joe and Kurt Angle, which, by the way, did 60,000 buys on pay-per-view, which TNA would probably kill for these days. But people bought into Joe as being a badass. And it's just like Paul Heyman. I mean, Joe's not that big of a guy, but Paul Heyman back in ECW, neither was Taz. But they made, you know, he knew how to push Taz, and Taz was the world champion. Taz was this big, badass dude who wasn't really all that big in reality, but people bought into it. And people bought into Samoa Joe. They were behind him. And then, I don't know what happened, but something happened. Somebody lost interest. Maybe Samoa Joe bumped into somebody who spilled coffee all over themselves. I don't know. But they got tired of Joe. They pushed him down the card. He got kidnapped. He came back with a tattoo on his face. He was running around with a machete. Then he was on a losing streak. He was jobbing to everybody. I think he had negative points a year ago in the Bound for Glory series. I mean, this guy was just 6 feet under. And I'm very happy to finally see them doing something with him, that he has a title on him. I mean, again, does TNA really need a television title? Probably not. But it's getting Joe over. You know, they're getting Joe back over again. The choke, the coquina clutch, you know, he's choking people out with it. That's one of the things about TNA that I like these days, because I know Samoa Joe can be a big star, and I think this perhaps is the beginnings of what will hopefully be a much bigger push for Samoa Joe, who I think can still be a big star and make that company a lot of money. So anyway, Joe retained his title. He defended it against Magnus at the pay-per-view, so he was successful. Joey Ryan beat Al Snow, so he earned himself a TNA contract. Apparently Matt Morgan now will be his bodyguard. As I mentioned before, Chavo and Hernandez won the tag team titles. Very sad to see Chris Daniels and Kazarian lose the straps, but perhaps they'll get them back at some point. James Storm and Bobby Roode had their big, it wasn't Last Man Standing, it was a Falls Count Anywhere brawl, I guess it was, or street fight, whatever the hell it was. King Mo was the guest enforcer at ringside. He did nothing. It was completely pointless for him to even be there. And James Storm wins what was a very bloody, very violent brawl. There was, he bled a gusher. Bobby Roode did too, but James Storm was wearing the proverbial crimson mask in this match. And they used weapons and Singapore canes and thumbtacks and the whole nine yards. They had a match that, yeah, to me, it was probably the match that would have been the main event of Bound for Glory. Again, the original plan that was talked about for months, it's no big secret, I don't think, was that Bobby Roode would defend the championship against James Storm, who would win the Bound for Glory series. They did that match at Lockdown earlier in the year, where Bobby Roode beat James Storm, but again, it was James Storm giving him the last call super kick, and Roode fell out of the cage, and you know, looking back, it really did stall the momentum of James Storm. I think it was not what TNA expected. Then they did the Aces and Eights stuff, where Bobby Roode was accusing James Storm of being behind it, and the fans actually bought into it. I mean, James Storm would show up on Impact and would get booed. So the fans started buying into something I don't think TNA expected them to buy into, and just all these different things happened, and James Storm took a very different path. Obviously, he did not win the Bound for Glory series. So we have James Storm and Bobby Roode as the third match on this show. It wasn't even like the co-main event or anything like that. But they went out there and they kicked each other's asses. They had a great match. They deserve a lot of credit for it. The fans were into it. It was good stuff. Sting and Bully Ray teamed up against Aces and Eights. I was shocked that they did not do the Bully Ray turn. I mean, just Bully Ray is probably one of the best bad guys in the business, probably the best heel in all of TNA. And just the way he was acting, and then he came out with the Sting face paint on, and I thought to myself, God, this guy's turning. There's absolutely no way he's not turning on Sting. And in fact, he did not turn on Sting. What happened is that D-Von was clad in a black outfit, put Bully through a table, helped Aces and Eights win the match, which, by the way, gives them full access to TNA. And then he got revealed, he got unmasked as being the Sergeant at Arms. As we would later learn, he is not the leader of Aces and Eights, which I never thought he was. I don't know why people assume that this meant D-Von was the leader. I thought it was just the first kind of reveal in what will be a series of reveals going forward. I'll get to Aces and Eights in a second. But it was D-Von. Apparently this was not the plan all along. This was something that came together only in the last 2 weeks or so. So D-Von really did leave TNA. There was, you know, his contract expired. They couldn't come to a new deal. And they had the idea that, why don't we bring D-Von back? People love him so much. And Hulk Hogan was a big advocate for him. So they brought him back. And to his credit, and this kind of bleeds into Impact on Thursday when D-Von came out and he cut that promo at the beginning of the show, I think D-Von so far, it's only been about a week, but so far, D-Von is fine in the role. D-Von's a very good talker. I think people want to like D-Von, but you know, he went out there, he told the people to shut up, and he did what he could do to turn them against him. I thought he was fine. I have no problem with D-Von in that role, and I'm happy to see him back on TV. Well, let me get to the main event here before I talk about Aces and Eights. We had Austin Aries and Jeff Hardy in the main event. They had a good match, you know, not a great match or anything like that. I thought Austin Aries and Bobby Roode had better matches, but in the end, Jeff Hardy wins clean with the Swanton Bomb 1-2-3, and he is the new TNA World Heavyweight Champion. They did the big celebration at the end. It was very interesting to see Jeff Hardy get the John Cena reaction when he came out in front of that crowd. I've never seen Jeff Hardy get a reaction like that from an audience before, but he got booed. He got booed by a good 80% of that crowd, and the people were cheering Austin Aries no matter what he did to try to turn them against him. This was one of those crowds that was going to go against the grain. They were not going to do what they were told to do. But in the end, people, and this is always funny to me, whenever you have a situation where you've got a babyface and the company clearly wants you to cheer for them, And the fans decide, you know what? Fuck that. We're not going to do what you tell us to do. And so they turn on the guy. They boo him, and they boo him, and they boo him. But in the end, when he wins, people cheer. And the best example I could think of that, go back to WrestleMania 18. Hulk Hogan and The Rock. Hulk Hogan nearly murdered The Rock in the build-up to WrestleMania that year. He literally tried to kill The Rock by driving a semi-truck into an ambulance where The Rock was loaded up into. Hit him in the head with a hammer. Tried to kill the guy. Tried to maim him. Hogan shows up at Sky Dome that year for WrestleMania and gets a hero's welcome. You would think that none of that happened. The Rock comes out. He gets booed. Second year in a row, by the way, because poor Rock had to wrestle Steve Austin in Texas the year prior. Even though he was a babyface, he got booed there too. But here comes Rock. And Rock rolled with the punches. He was great in that match. You know, the people were really healing up on him. And they were booing him. And The Rock was playing along. It was great. And so in the end, what happens? The Rock pins Hulk Hogan with a rock bottom. And all of a sudden, the people cheer. Yay! We're happy to see The Rock win. These fickle fans out there. So, of course, here it was no different. Jeff Hardy gets the pin. People, for the most part, cheered. They went nuts. Probably more so because they saw a title change. And Jeff Hardy is your new world champion. So that leads into Impact this past Thursday night. And I think I can safely say at this point that this Aces and Eights stuff is absolutely, positively killing my interest in the TNA product. Not that I'm ready to give up on Impact or anything like that. The show is still far better than it was even a year ago, but for a good stretch of time this summer, Impact was really fun to watch. It was a breath of fresh air. It was a nice change of pace from Monday Night Raw. And on some level, it still is. Again, the two shows are, they can be similar, but they're also very different. Again, there are things TNA has done. The gut check stuff I happen to like. The open fight night, I fucking hate. I give them points for trying something different. I don't like open fight night. I don't know if they've dropped open fight night or not. They are not previewing open fight night for next week. They're promoting Championship Thursday. I thought usually that went hand in hand with open fight night. So maybe they've come to their senses and they've dropped this stupid concept. But like gut check is something I think is a good idea. The X Division stuff, when they were featuring the guys like Kenny King and Rubik's, who only made like two appearances. I don't know why the hell they haven't had Rubik's back. That was really good stuff. And the Aces and Eights thing clearly is designed to be a modern-day adaptation of the NWO angle. I mean, look who's in charge of this. Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff are working behind the scenes in TNA. The same people that were in WCW at the time when the NWO was big. So it should be no surprise they're trying to go back to the well and recreate something that worked at one time and will not work now. It just is, it's not going to work. And the big difference to me is this. The NWO, one of the reasons, and by no means is this the only reason. I mean, the main reason the NWO worked, first of all, wrestling was so much more popular at the time. You had a legitimate war between two companies. And the whole genesis of the NWO was that these two guys showed up, and the way they handled it, the way they booked it, the way they presented it was such that people really thought these were two guys invading from another promotion. I mean, the last time they saw Scott Hall on TV, he was Razor Ramon. And the last time they saw Kevin Nash, he was Big Daddy Cool Diesel. Holy shit, what are they doing on Nitro? And WWE may not have been very happy with WCW kind of tricking the fans into thinking there was a real invasion going on, but it was a brilliant move on their part, and the NWO took off from there. So there were a lot of reasons why the NWO was successful back then. But the thing is this. The NWO at least had faces and names. When somebody joined, when somebody turned, oh my God, I can't believe they've turned on WCW, we knew who it was. When the Giant turned, we knew it was the Giant. When Scott Steiner turned heel and became Big Papa Pump and was part of the NWO, we knew it was Scott Steiner. And Buff Bagwell, excuse me, and everybody else who ended up hooking up until it got to the point where far too many no names joined the NWO, then it started to go downhill. But they had faces and they had names. They had identities. We knew who they were. We could relate to them. We can get to like them. We can get to hate them, whatever the case may be. But they were people. It's hard to care much about a bunch of masked men who we don't know. It's just a bunch of guys coming out every week wearing their Halloween costumes. And to be perfectly honest with you, if that's what I want to see, I'll just go out next weekend to any bar in New York City on Saturday night next weekend when everybody I'm sure is going to be celebrating Halloween, and I can see the same goddamn thing. I don't have to waste 2 hours of my time watching this shit on TV every Thursday. You know, it's nice they finally did a reveal with D-Von. But, I mean, what really has changed? What really has changed from this week to last week with Aces and Eights? Now they have access. So now they can enter the arena without being thrown out. Okay, so what? Who cares? Another Impact this week ends exactly like Nitro used to end back in the day. The difference is, WCW was really popular back then, and people were really into it. And you had a lot of babyface. You know, you had Sting, you had DDP who was getting over, you had Goldberg. So you had these fighting forces that could fight back against the NWO each and every week when Nitro would ultimately go off the air with some big brawl. That's exactly what we got again on Impact this week. Only the difference is, people don't give a shit. The fans could not possibly care less in the Impact Zone on Thursday. I felt the same way. Another show ends with some big brawl. That's how the show started on Thursday night. They started with a big brawl. Great! That gets the show off to a rip-roaring start. Show ended the exact same way. Nothing was accomplished. How many weeks are we supposed to see Aces and Eights come out? They brawl, they run away, somebody comes out with a baseball bat, chases them away, and nothing is solved. Have we been given any indication at all of why Aces and Eights wants to tear down TNA? Did I miss something? What is their motivation? Why do they care? Why do they want to harm TNA? I mean, in the end, it may be revealed that Eric Bischoff is behind it, and of course, Bischoff got bounced from power many, many months ago, so in that respect, it would make sense that Eric Bischoff has taken his revenge on TNA for the way he was treated, and maybe he's the one behind Aces and Eights. He was definitely the person, he was the, quote, leader a couple of weeks ago. That doesn't mean he'll be revealed as the leader when the mask comes off. I mean, that would make sense on some level, I suppose. But we're reaching that point now where unless they move this story along a little bit quicker, or they give us some other piece of the puzzle here, this is just boring television. You know, the Aces and Eights stuff used to draw the biggest quarter hours on Impact, which, you know, maybe you don't care about. The fans shouldn't give a shit about the ratings, but they do. And the Aces and Eights stuff was drawing before, and now, not so much. Because people are losing interest. It's a bunch of masked dudes that nobody knows and nobody cares about. At least if you start unmasking them. You don't want to reveal who the leaders are, that's fine. All these other bit players, what's the big deal? Take the mask off. Now, if it's somebody like Luke Gallows or Mike Knox or Chris Masters or Wes Briscoe, these are not big names. It's not going to matter. But at least they can start to develop their own personalities. They can start to cut promos. We can learn a little bit about who they are. Why did they join Aces and Eights? What's their motivation? What's in it for them? I don't know anything at this point, and I don't care. But these shows are built around this thing that, you know, people are starting to care less and less about. You know, the Joseph Park stuff, and I'm still convinced on some level that he must be in on this, but whether it's him or Abyss or whatever. But there's also that aspect to it also, which I hate, which is the completely bullshit, unrealistic aspect of it. They kidnapped this poor guy, this lawyer, this attorney. They held him captive for like a month. Nobody in TNA seemed to give a shit. They would show poor Joe Park getting, you know, just shocked with I don't even know what the hell it was. They were torturing this poor guy in some cave somewhere, some clubhouse, down in the basement. And it was comical the way that Mike Tenay would then go like, well, that was interesting. Moving on. I mean, at least make it feel somewhat, you know, realistic, like you actually give a shit, like, oh my god, this guy is being torn, we gotta get some help for this guy, something has to be done. But nope, they would move on. It's just another wrestling angle, no big deal. So that kind of took me out of it to begin with. But now we're at a point where enough is enough. You know, Ryback loves to say, feed me more, is what I would say to TNA, feed me more. Feed me the next piece of the puzzle, make me care about this Aces and Eights bullshit. Because I can't possibly see how anybody could care about this. And it's dragging down the show. You know, there's some good wrestling on Impact. There was a great match this week with Chris Daniels, Kurt Angle, and AJ Styles. And Kurt Angle earned himself a potential shot at the World Championship. He's going to be in a match next week. That was a good match. They had a tag match on the show with Kid Cash and Gunner against Chavo and Hernandez. Yeah, it really wasn't anything special, but whatever. It was a fine wrestling match. Yeah, there's some good stuff on Impact, but this Aces and Eights stuff, everything is built around Aces and Eights, and Hulk Hogan comes out with a baseball bat. Enough! Enough! I don't need to see Hulk Hogan walking out with a baseball bat every single week, chasing people away, people running into his fist and falling down and having to bump and sell for this guy. We're supposed to take these guys seriously. They're a threat to TNA. They want to tear down this company. But they look like a bunch of punks. They look like a bunch of dorks. The other aspect of this that I'm completely sick and tired of is the fact that here we are with yet another wrestling invasion angle. If I don't see another wrestling invasion angle for the rest of my life, it'll be too soon. You know, when they did the Nexus thing in WWE 2 years ago, that was actually very well done. You had a group of guys that people got to know over the course of, 12 weeks or whatever it was on that first season of NXT, and they decided to band together for a common cause. They were tired of being made fun of by their pros and being held down and being told they had to pay their dues. So they banded together and they went and they beat the shit out of the biggest dog in the yard. They went and they beat up John Cena on night one and they complete mayhem and destruct. They beat up everybody. They beat up the ring announcer. They beat up Jerry Lawler. It was actually very well done. And for the first several weeks, Nexus was a big hit. They beat up the legends. They were a force to be reckoned with. Now, of course, they ended up dropping the ball on the whole Nexus thing and killing them 2 months later at SummerSlam, but forget that. That was actually well done. That might have been the last well-done invasion, quote, invasion angle that that I've seen on TV. The NWO worked, to go back to that, since Aces and Eights is a ripoff of that. May as well talk about the original here. The reason the NWO worked, there were a lot of reasons why the NWO worked. As I mentioned a few moments ago, chief among them was the fact that people actually thought, at least at the beginning, this may be a legitimate invasion. You had two companies, two warring factions on television each and every week. 10 million wrestling people combined watching wrestling on television every Monday night. Wrestling has never been hotter than it was during that period. So people bought into it, and it was cool. They were the cool heels. Hall and Nash and Six-Pac and all of them. It worked. And the NWO obviously got ran into the ground, but they got a lot of mileage out of them. And the NWO dominated for a good 2 years before it started to fizzle out. And you had the other factions, the Wolfpack and Team Black and White and all that BS. But to me, you don't do an invasion angle in wrestling anymore because it just doesn't work unless it is a legitimate thing where two companies can come together. And maybe they've done this in Mexico, I don't know. But if you can get two wrestling promotions, and this will never, ever happen with WWE and TNA, unless Vince buys TNA one day. And his track record of doing invasion angles at that point is not exactly sterling. He could have spun WCW off as a separate entity, which was the original plan. They were actually having meetings for months planning how WCW would be run as a separate brand, and then Booker T and Buff Bagwell basically shot that straight to hell. But unless something like that were to happen, if you can find two wrestling promotions willing to work together on a co-branded pay-per-view to do some sort of invasion angle, Ring of Honor and CZW many years ago did this, they worked together, and that was very exciting stuff, fine, do it. That could work. That could be very exciting. Otherwise, I think the days of these wrestling invasion angles are done. Aces and Eights is evidence of that to me. People don't buy it. It doesn't work. It's been done so many times that unless you can actually bring two companies together and do a legitimate invasion angle, it's just not believable. People don't care. So they're doing another invasion angle here that I think part of the problem is that a lot of people just don't buy into it. It feels like it's just another part of the show. Oh, look, it's Aces and Eights. They're walking around backstage. You know, what's going to happen now? Whoop-de-doo. It doesn't have that same level of excitement that the previous ones had. You know, they're basing this off an angle that got over 13 years ago. It doesn't work that way anymore. So these wrestling invasion angles have got to go. Unless you've got a really, really good idea to help get this thing over. You've got two promotions willing to work together, and that's a rare occurrence. It doesn't happen very often because usually, you know, two companies, every company is competition for the other company, and people want their guys to go over, and it usually just doesn't work out. But if you can do something like that, go for it. That could be really cool. Otherwise, I think this is evidence that wrestling invasion angles, you know, unless you have some wonderfully creative idea that's never been done before, just don't work anymore. And that's one of the reasons I think also why this Aces and Eights thing, it's not doing it for me. It's not doing it for a lot of people. Let's get to some of your questions here. Mailbag time. You can email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. There are a ton of people who have emailed me over the last week or so, week and a half, who I have not responded to. I have gotten your emails. I've fallen way behind. I promise I will try to get to as many of them either on air or directly as I can. So keep emailing me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. We'll start out here with a message. I have not even looked at some of these yet, so we're doing this in real time. This comes from David. David Menigo, Silver Spring, Maryland. Most of us remember the ECW One Night Stand pay-per-view from 2006. What stood out was the time when John Cena threw his shirt to the audience only to have it thrown back. After trying and failing three more times, Cena just tossed it to the ground. Since that moment, Cena has been the babyface we love to hate. Do you think the treatment of John Cena at that pay-per-view back in 2006 was a contributing factor to ECW gradually becoming a crappy developmental show? No, I don't, actually. I think ECW was destined to become a crappy developmental show anyway because Vince McMahon never really wanted ECW to be a huge success anyway. It's not like he actually had plans to spin it off as something separate or... If he really wanted to give ECW its own identity, he could have. The first one or two shows, it kind of did. They had the people coming out through the crowd. They had like a separate aisleway through the crowd and you know, I guess their idea of being creative was having Kelly Kelly being the pole dancer on the show, doing her little extreme expose stuff. It was good for a while. It was different. And then they just lost interest. I mean, in some respects, I don't think it's any different than Superstars. And you'll see, a month or two from now, Main Event, even though I love the show now, I like the format of the show, it's not going to be a priority 2 months from now. It's just going to be another show that they have to have. They'll tape a match before they tape Raw and SmackDown. And they'll throw it on there, and it's just another show that's just not a priority to them. And I think that's just what ECW became. It was just another show with a bunch of guys nobody knew. Some of them got over. It was a nice way to get some of these guys on TV when they would not have otherwise been on TV. Whether it was a Kevin Thorne or any of these other people, some of whom, you know, are not around anymore. But I don't think John Cena's negative reaction in the Hammerstein Ballroom at One Night Stand had anything to do with it. It's not like John's, you know, it was a eureka moment for Vince McMahon where he said, whoa, he's like, you know, forget this. I'm gonna destroy this brand. How dare you boo my top babyface? I mean, he was probably getting booed at that point anyway. In fact, I know he was. John Cena got booed out of the building at WrestleMania 22 a couple months earlier in his match with Triple H. It wasn't like ECW One Night Stand in 06 was the first time the fans had turned on John Cena. They were already starting to turn on John Cena. And ECW was destined to fail because they never believed in ECW enough to begin with. Some people to this day still believe the only reason that Vince McMahon even green-lit ECW being turned into a separate brand and being built up the way that it was built up at first was so that it would kill off the ECW chance that he would still hear in the arenas. ECW, for all intents and purposes, died in 2001, and still, I mean, it still happens even to this day. You'll never actually fully get rid of the ECW chants, but you would still hear ECW chanted a lot back then, and some people believe it was Vince McMahon's way of ultimately killing off that chant, because now if people chant ECW, well, it's something I've created. They're chanting for my brand, which, of course, is bullshit. And it did kind of kill the ECW chant a little bit, but I don't think it would have been a success either way, because I don't think they actually wanted it to be successful. Dan from Bristol, England, writes in, on the back of your ROH talk last week, I was wondering if you could pinpoint where it all went wrong. Did it ever recover, that being Ring of Honor, from losing Bryan Danielson and Nigel McGuinness? You know, I think part of it is definitely the fact that they lost a lot of their big names over the years. Samoa Joe, Bryan Danielson, Nigel McGuinness. But the fact is, Ring of Honor, I don't remember exactly when the period was, if it was when Jim Cornette came over to the promotion, if perhaps it was his vision of how things should be, if it was when, you know, they kicked out Gabe Sapolsky. But Ring of Honor was always known as being an entirely different product from anything you would get on WWE or TNA television. And I had been to a lot of Ring of Honor shows, so I can comment on this, because I was at numerous live Ring of Honor events. And the one thing that always struck me about it, it was a hard-hitting product. You would go, it almost reminded me of some Japanese matches that I would on occasion see, I would watch on YouTube or Daily Motion or something. Very hard-hitting, lots of kicks, lots of it was pro wrestling, but you could tell these guys in the ring were kind of like, you know what, I'm going to beat the crap out of you, you can beat the crap out of me, let's make this look as realistic as possible. And it was. It was a very, very hard-hitting style. They would do some unbelievably crazy, psychotic maneuvers. I'll never forget, I was at an event, I forgot the name of which Ring of Honor show it was. It may have been their last show at the New Yorker Hotel, which would have been, I want to say, June of 2007, but I could be wrong about that. But I vividly recall there was a match. It was BJ Whitmer. I want to say it was Jimmy Jacobs. It could have been somebody else, but it was definitely BJ Whitmer. And they did this spot from the top rope to the floor. Not just to the floor, but into the audience. They had cleared an area. They cleared a small section away. They moved the chairs away on what was probably, maybe it was carpeted, I don't remember, but it was over the barricade and in the audience. And BJ Whitmer did a powerbomb on his opponent from the top rope inside the ring, over the barricade, into the crowd, onto the floor. And I lost sight of them because I was on the opposite side of the building. And I was just, I remember watching that, and like time stood still because I thought these guys were dead. It was Jimmy Jacobs, whoever was being powerbombed, I thought, he's dead. He's dead. It was something I had never seen before. And it was one of many things like that. That's the one, for whatever reason, that sticks out to me. That was the same show where Bryan Danielson, Daniel Bryan, call him what you will, almost wiped me out on a dive into the crowd onto Samoa Joe because I wasn't paying attention. Pay attention. But things like that were commonplace in Ring of Honor at the time. A lot of sick moves. Nigel McGuinness took so much abuse to the head, and who knows? I mean, he's never actually revealed the nature of why he had to retire from in-ring competition. It wouldn't shock me if it had something to do with all of the abuse to his head that the poor guy took over the years. I mean, and not just to his head. I mean, Nigel got beaten up something fierce during his time in Ring of Honor. I remember he had, I think, a torn bicep on both arms that he could not have surgically repaired because he didn't have insurance. He didn't have the money to afford it. So he had two torn biceps that I don't know were ever surgically repaired. And a lot of guys in Ring of Honor, you know, practically tortured each other like that for the entertainment of the audience because the audience had very high expectations for what they would see when they went to a Ring of Honor show. And at some point, and it may have been, again, when Jim Cornette came over, the decision was made that we're going to tone that down. You can't keep going balls to the wall like that. I mean, look at a lot of the old ECW guys from the Paul Heyman era, the ones that are still around that aren't 6 feet under. Some of these guys look pretty good, you know. I mean, I've seen guys like Too Cold Scorpio and some of those guys who don't look half bad these days. And then there are other guys like Balls Mahoney where you look at them and go, holy shit, what happened to these guys? It looks like the Walking Dead come to life. And I guess the mindset was similar to that, in that if you keep wrestling a hard style like this, it's going to be bad times for you down the road. So let's tone it down a little bit. And the other problem with Ring of Honor back in the day, at least to some people, was that you would have every single person who went out there for a match up and down the card that had the same thing in mind. I want to go out there. I want to have like a main event level match. I want to go out there and do some crazy move or some crazy spot from the opening match right down to the main event. And the reality is you can't do that in every single match. And if you're in the main event, I could see where some main event guys would look at that and go, what the hell? You know, you're having guys go out there in the second match on the card doing these wacky flip dives. You know, you got to save some of that for us. Save it for the main event. Save it for the big matches. Because up and down the card, every match was like a car crash. And it was very entertaining to watch. But at some point, there was a change. And the decision was made, we have to tone things down. Even if the fans don't like it, it's going to be an education for them. It's going to be a learning curve. People are not going to like it at first. We have to save that stuff for the key matches, save that stuff for the main events. And Ring of Honor started to turn into a very, you know, and this may be an extreme thing to say, but a WWE-esque product in that they were introducing more characters and more, you know, fuck finishes and stuff like that, that I don't think Ring of Honor fans liked and that they weren't accustomed to. And I think that's when things started to change, maybe not for the better. That's when people started to say, this is not the Ring of Honor product that I came to love. And on top of that, all the big stars started leaving because Ring of Honor couldn't afford to keep them, or they had better opportunities in TNA or WWE. I mean, a lot of guys came from Ring of Honor. Chris Daniels was in Ring of Honor. AJ Styles was in Ring of Honor. Austin Aries was in Ring of Honor, went to TNA, came back, then went back to TNA again, and obviously has had a lot greater success the second time around as Austin Aries, as opposed to Austin Starr, which is what they called him back in the day. And then losing a McGinnis and losing a Danielson and a Joe, I mean, that was a big blow to the company. And, you know, I'm going to a Ring of Honor show myself because it's been far too long. I haven't gone to a show in like 2 or 3 years. So I've got my ticket to go to the WrestleMania weekend show in New York next year, and I'm looking forward to it. And hopefully the company, you know, will still be around at that point. I'm sure they will be. But, you know, I'm going into this Ring of Honor show, and I don't even know if I'll know half the guys on the card. I mean, I know who Kevin Steen is. I know who the King, not the Kings of Wrestling, the, you know, Haas and Benjamin and Michael Elgin and Davey Richards. You know, and even somebody like an Adam Cole or Kyle O'Reilly, I'm at least familiar with them now. But there's a ton of guys in that roster who I've never seen wrestle live. I wouldn't know them from a frickin' hole in the wall. Now, as a wrestling fan, that doesn't necessarily deter me from buying a ticket. I don't need to have big stars up and down the card that I know every single person, you know, as a prerequisite for me going to a show. But I could see where that would turn a lot of people off. So there's a couple of different things I think that you could trace back to kind of this tidal wave of change in Ring of Honor that have led the company to the point that it's at now. And you throw in the iPay-per-view disasters that they've had, and it's created a situation where Ring of Honor is in, you know, I could say rough shape, but it's definitely not as healthy, I think, as it could be. And there are people, and I talked about this a week or two ago, where, you know, Ring of Honor, 2013 is going to be a very pivotal year for that company as far as whether or not it lives or dies. I firmly believe that. And hopefully it survives, and hopefully it creates new stars. Because only recently has Vince McMahon and WWE came to the realization, when they look at their roster and they look at their developmental talent, only recently have they seemingly come to the realization, holy shit, you know, this Ring of Honor promotion here, they got a lot of talented guys. Because all these guys ultimately came from ROH, or they passed through ROH. They became big stars there. Cassius Ohno, Antonio Cesaro, these are going to be big names down the road. They started in ROH. Punk and Danielson. WWE would be up Schitt's Creek without a paddle earlier this year if it wasn't for those two guys. Daniel Bryan has been moved down the card, but even so, he's all over the place now. Him and Kane, it's one of the biggest things that, you know, you'll see on Raw and SmackDown when you put TV on every week. They rely on those guys so much that only now, I think, are they coming to the realization that, you know, we've got this wealth of talent that we could have probably gotten a lot earlier. And maybe now, perhaps, they'll lend a helping hand even to Ring of Honor if they had to. They did that with ECW back in the day. You know, they pumped some money into ECW to help keep it alive. Maybe they'll do the same thing with Ring of Honor. I think they should. I think it's in their best interest. I think it's investing in their future. Ring of Honor is not going to compete with them on pay-per-view. Ring of Honor is not going to compete with them on cable TV. What's the harm? This letter here comes from Robert, dear Solomonster. With the push of Ryback that we're currently seeing, I was wondering if you think he would have been bigger as Skip Sheffield or as he is now as Ryback. I don't think it would have mattered either way. It's the same guy. It's like Steve Austin, you know. He would have been, you know, the Ringmaster was a shitty name, but at the end of the day, I think he would have become a star no matter what. Ryback, I happen to like as a better name just because it harkens back to the days when guys actually had names that weren't just their real name. You know what I mean? You had tag teams like Demolition, and you had people like the Barbarian and the Warlord. I don't know what the fuck a Ryback is, but it sounds pretty cool. So if I had to choose between the two names, I'd pick Ryback over Skip Sheffield. But this brings up another point that I wanted to just talk about here. I heard somebody on another podcast, and I won't name names, but they were talking about Ryback, and somebody made the comment that one time, as Skip Sheffield, Ryback was one step away from being cut. You know, back in the day before his injury, that the ankle injury that happened to Ryback may have been the best thing to happen to his career. Because as Skip Sheffield, you know, with the cowboy hat on and everything, he was inevitably just going to be cut. And when I heard that, I thought to myself, boy, that person must not be watching the same product that I was watching. Because I could have sworn that before he suffered his ankle injury that kept him out for over a year, he had already pretty much abandoned the whole corn-fed meathead gimmick with the cowboy hat, and he was looking pretty dominant as part of the Nexus faction before he got hurt. So I'm not quite sure what that person was watching, or what they were smoking, or what the deal is. But I said even back then, the path that I saw for Ryback was clear, in that he was going to be a big star. Go back and listen to any of those early sound offs where I talked about it. Don't ask me for a number because I couldn't tell you which number it was. But the way I envisioned it going was very similar to a Batista Evolution deal. You had Wade Barrett as the clear-cut leader of Nexus. Okay, he was the leader. He was the head guy. Ryback, at the time, Skip Sheffield, was the enforcer of the group. Again, he had long abandoned the silly cowboy gimmick. So I don't know what this person is talking about, but he was the guy that would go in there and beat people up. He was the enforcer of the group. Much like Batista was in a lot of ways, I think, for Evolution back in the day. And the way I figured it was going to go, perhaps, if Sheffield had not been injured, was that Barrett would continue to rule with an iron fist and maybe treat some of his people when they would start to... You'd start to see some of the chinks in the armor and there would be some dissension in the ranks. Ryback would be the guy who was not going to take shit from Wade Barrett. And so you could have done the slow build, where people are starting to kind of see things for how they are, kind of like they did with Batista. Each week, he starts to get these reactions. People are just dying. They're waiting to see Skip Sheffield just absolutely beat the crap out of Wade Barrett and put him in his place. And I think that probably would have been the direction they would have gone in. It was a sensible direction. I think that would have built up Skip Sheffield as being a big star. And ultimately, whether they called him Skip Sheffield or Ryback, he would have been, a big dude either way. You know, he would have gotten over, I think, with the crowd. That's how I would have seen it going. But I just heard that and I thought, wait, what are you talking about? He would have been cut. He wasn't even doing the cowboy gimmick at that point. He was well on his way to getting over as a major star, either a heel or a face. Unfortunately, he got hurt. Now, he came back as Ryback, and so far things have worked out well for him. So I would say the injury, all the injury did was it delayed the inevitable nature of him getting over. It was just a delay in his career. It wasn't a blessing in disguise. I think that's a ridiculous thing to say. He suffered it's a very major injury that he suffered. Most people suffer an ankle injury. They're not out for as long as he was. He had a couple of operations. I don't think he healed properly the first time. There was some question if he would even be able to come back. Now, I don't think he minds the fact that he came back and he got over and he's doing very well for himself right now. But, you know, it's not as though if it wasn't for the injury, he would have been cut. I think that's complete bullshit. I think Vince McMahon has always loved the fact that he's a big jacked up dude. He's, you know, big, strong guy, just like Vince loves. And he's got a bit of personality to him, so I think he would have been a big star either way. I don't think he would have even come close to being cut. Anybody who thinks that doesn't know what they're talking about. Shane wants to know, if Jeff Hardy does come back to WWE, would you like him to act as a mentor towards Justin Gabriel and give him a push? No, actually, I would not. If I paid Jeff Hardy enough money to come back to my company, I would want to position him at the top as a main event guy, because that's why I'm bringing him back. That's where he is best used. Now, if you want to do something down the road where, you know, he takes Justin Gabriel under his wing and does some tag matches with him and all that, that's fine. I wouldn't bring Jeff Hardy back to, specifically be a mentor towards anybody. I would bring Jeff Hardy back as a main event guy. That is if I decide to bring Jeff Hardy back. And I'm sure WWE would love to have Jeff Hardy back. And it's going to be very interesting come February of next year to see what happens, even if he is still the TNA champion, because every time Jeff gets asked about that in interviews, he gives a very nondescript kind of evasive answer, which he should. If he's smart, he's not going to close the door. You know, he may want to pit the two sides against each other if he's smart, try to earn as much money as he can. This may well be the last big contract he gets, depending on how long it is, so he's smart for doing that. But no, if I bring Jeff Hardy back, at least initially, I don't bring him back with the intention of him mentoring anybody. I mean, maybe long term they could do something like that, but I bring him back as a main event guy because if there's one thing WWE needs right now, and I just talked about this earlier, on the babyface side on Raw, on their flagship show, they're lacking in the babyface department right now. They could really benefit by having somebody like Jeff Hardy. If they have just brought Jeff Hardy back a couple of weeks ago and John Cena went down with an injury, all you do is plug Jeff Hardy in, you've got a huge main event. Jeff Hardy and CM Punk in a Hell in a Cell match, although, again, I don't know that I would want to just kind of give that match away so quickly, but at least they would have options. So, to me, that's why Jeff Hardy is most valuable. That's where he is most valuable to WWE. It's on the babyface side on that Raw brand, not SmackDown, on the Raw brand. Luke from North Carolina has a question. He's been a listener since episode 72. Do you think 2013 is the year that the late, great, ravishing Rick Rude finally makes it into the WWE Hall of Fame? His name has come up on a number of WWE.com lists of late, even topping the 20 most impressive physiques. I know I'm possibly reading too much into this, but do you figure Vince McMahon has forgiven him for the double showing of Raw and Nitro back in 1997, and that next year is going to be his year? Following up, if Rick Rude is inducted, who do you think should be his inductor? If he were able, Bobby Heenan would make sense, but I'd personally go with Paul Heyman, since Rude had way more success in WCW as part of the Dangerous Alliance. First of all, Rick Rude deserves to go into the Hall of Fame. He should already be in the Hall of Fame. Is next year going to be the year? It's impossible to say. I mean, it's not a name I've heard pop up of late. I've heard names like Bob Backlund and Mick Foley, Ultimate Warrior, Kevin Nash. I have not heard Rick Rude's name mentioned. But then again, it's something that I'm sure in a few months will come up. They're going to want to induct one or two people posthumously who are no longer with us. Unfortunately, Rick Rude is among those people. He passed away many years ago. He would not be there to accept on his own behalf, which I think is a shame. But should he be inducted into the Hall of Fame? Absolutely, he should be. As far as who should put him into the Hall of Fame, you know, Bobby Heenan, you say Bobby Heenan would make sense, and I can understand why you would say that. Bobby Heenan always told the story that Rick Rude was one of the only, if not the only person he ever managed that he felt, at least, did not like him. Because he felt that, or maybe Rude flat out said, that he felt Bobby Heenan was kind of taking away some of his heat whenever he was out there performing, doing interviews or what have you. And so Bobby Heenan has told the story before that Rick Rude was one of the few guys he's ever managed that didn't like him. So I'm not sure what the nature of the relationship was. I don't know that it was a great relationship the two of them had. Of all the people that Bobby Heenan has managed over the years, I don't know that he would necessarily be the best person to be inducting Rick Rude. And of course he can't, unfortunately, anyway, even if he wanted to. Here's a name for you. Why not Bret Hart? Most people don't associate Rick Rude with Bret Hart, but Bret Hart has talked before, and go watch his DVD. He gets very emotional about what a good friend Rick Rude was to him. They were very good friends. Bret Hart thinks the world of Rick Rude, and a lot of that has to do with what happened in Montreal back in 97. You know, Rick Rude was one of the guys who defended Bret Hart to Eric Bischoff and the people in WCW when they were having second thoughts or they were questioning whether or not they should be bringing Bret Hart over. And Rick Rude was in the locker room in Montreal the night that the screwjob happened, so he saw everything unfold as it happened, and he told Eric Bischoff exactly what went down. He vouched for Bret Hart. He put a good word in for him, and Bret talks about that, I think, on the DVD. He never forgot that. They were very good friends. Unfortunately, they never had a chance to work a program together in WWF, although I think on Bret's DVD they include one match that may have taken place overseas. I don't recall between him and Rick Rude, but you know, Bret Hart might not be a bad name to consider for that. It's a way to get Bret Hart as part of WrestleMania weekend, and I think it would mean a lot to him to be able to induct Rick Rude when that day comes. Steven from the Isle of Man, UK, writes in, wanted to know if he can get a quick shout-out. He will be celebrating his 21st birthday next Saturday, the 27th, so happy early birthday to Steven. Two quick questions he has here. Concerning the 2002 Royal Rumble, The Undertaker was eliminated from the Rumble match by Maven, that being Maven of Tough Enough fame. After that, Taker went berserk and killed Maven. Did anything ever come of this after the pay-per-view? I don't recall any sort of feud between the two happening after this. And if not, what was the point in having Taker absolutely destroy Maven? Well, to me, it was just a really cool moment that they wanted to do. If you go back and watch it, the place exploded when Maven drop-kicked The Undertaker out of the ring. He was distracted by the Hardy Boys outside. Maven nailed him with a drop-kick. Taker went out, landed on his feet, place went apeshit. And Maven jumped up on the ropes. He was celebrating like he had just won the main event of WrestleMania. And it was just a way for them to do a really shocking thing in the Rumble match that I'm sure nobody expected. And I just took it to be, you know what? Undertaker just gave Maven a very cool moment, and now Undertaker has to get some payback. Because we can't have Undertaker looking weak by being eliminated by the Tough Enough Kid. So just to get some of his heat back, Undertaker went and absolutely killed Maven. I mean, he just destroyed him with a chair shot to the head. Maven bladed. They brawled all over the arena. I recall them being up by a popcorn machine. I think they brawled up onto the lobby level, into the concession stands and all that. To me, I just took it to be an isolated thing for the Rumble. You know, they wanted to give Maven a cool moment. They wanted to have that one oh my god moment at the Rumble that year, which I think that was it. And Undertaker could not be made to look too weak, so he had to get some of his heat back, so he beat the crap out of the kid. And like you said, I don't recall, unless they did something on Raw the next night that I don't remember, they never did a program or anything like that that I'm aware of. Second question here, keeping with the theme of the Royal Rumble, who do I think will be the potential winner of next year's Royal Rumble match? Steven says, as a Brit, I'd love to see Wade Barrett win. I also thought a surprise, perhaps, returning Jack Swagger could benefit a lot from winning the match. Well, that's not going to happen. Who do I think will win the Rumble next year? Wade Barrett wouldn't shock me. I said before, I could see Sheamus and Wade Barrett one year at a WrestleMania one year. Maybe next year's the year. Sheamus is still the world champion. You have Wade Barrett win. He meets Sheamus. Could happen. I don't know that it's a likely thing that's going to happen. I could just as easily see John Cena winning the Royal Rumble. If you're going to have The Rock and CM Punk at Rumble, and Rock wins the championship, and the plan right now for WrestleMania next year is Rock vs. Cena 2 for the title, John Cena wins the Rumble, he challenges Rock for the championship. I don't necessarily want to see John Cena win his second Royal Rumble. I don't think he has to, but he's as likely as anybody, one would think. Lastly here, I got a couple of emails from people who heard my little rant during the mailbag last week on the Attitude Era, and I posed the question, what does the Attitude Era mean to you? I got several responses, some very long ones that I can't get to on the air here, but I did want to mention a few of them here. One person, Edward from Charlotte, North Carolina. This is in response to your question on what do fans really mean when they say, we want Attitude back. I think the problem with fans is that they don't know how to express themselves. At one time, I would even say I wanted the PG era to be gone and bring back the Attitude Era. But as time went by, I would ask myself, what do I really mean by that? And the thing is, I didn't necessarily mean I wanted Stone Cold back, or The Rock, or chairs, blood, and tits. I was actually referring to good television, simple as that. But again, just like many fans out there, I didn't know how to express myself, and I would only repeat what everyone else was saying without realizing and understanding what the hell I was talking about. I'm glad there are shows like yours that can educate a lot of confused wrestling fans out there. So that comes from Edward. And the last thing here comes from Justin from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It says, I frequently listen to TV tracks on YouTube, and I recently heard your Attitude Era vs. PG Era question, and I must say I was a bit shocked that you agreed with the gentleman posing the question. Don't get me wrong, I understand why the Attitude Era shouldn't be brought back, and yes, I am very nostalgic because I grew up right in the middle of it, but I think certain aspects of the Attitude Era could greatly improve the show we're seeing. I don't need to see Triple H humping a corpse in a Kane mask or a hand and Jimmy Hoffa being pulled out of Mae Young's vagina, but it would be nice to see some more moderate aspects of that era return to the ring. I, for one, miss real technical wrestling. I miss suplexes, power bombs, high flying, and yes, maybe a chair shot and a table every now and then. Hell, promos that shoot from the hip and not a prompter so that the cream rises to the top, to quote a famous former wrestler, I like that too. That alone can help the WWE identify what they can do creatively for the talent so that the promos they cut will not sound so fake as they do today. I understand that I can watch TNA, but when I watch TNA, it feels like they are still living in the Attitude Era, not moving with the times. I think full-blown PG is doomed, and a switch to full-blown Attitude is also doomed, but there has to be a common middle ground here, where I'm not fast-forwarding to watch the same three wrestlers every week. Just my thoughts, none meant to be offensive. So that comes from Justin in Pittsburgh, PA. Makes some very good points. Thank you for writing in. Thanks to everybody else for writing in as well. Like I said, I do see everything. I try to respond. And those that I did not get to this week, I will definitely try to do so. And you can keep sending in your questions and shout-outs. rebuttals and what have you to thesolemonster@gmail.com is the quickest, best, and easiest way to reach me. thesolemonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is @solemonster. We are racking up followers. I very much appreciate that. Facebook.com/thesolemonster is the shortcut to our official Facebook profile page. There's a official group on Facebook as well. If you type the name of the show in the search box, it'll come right up. I can approve you when you apply for membership. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. It is free. It costs you nothing but time. Type in Solemonster Sounds Off. You subscribe, and every time a new show goes up, it will be automatically downloaded for you. And I want to say thank you to all the people this past week who left feedback for me in iTunes. They rated the show. You can give the show a star rating. You can leave actual feedback on what you think about the show. It's helpful to us, and I am very much appreciative to people who do that. So if you haven't already done so, please go on iTunes if you have a moment and leave some feedback there as well. So that's going to wrap up episode 242 this week. I want to thank you, as always, for downloading the show. Very much appreciate that. I guess next weekend might be the Halloween show. Halloween falls on a Wednesday this year, and next weekend is the final weekend before Halloween. So yeah, I guess next weekend is, in fact, the Halloween show. I can't believe it. It's already here. So that'll be episode 243 next week. So until then, be well, stay safe, and we'll see you right back here next week. Take it easy, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solemonster Sounds Off on SCScoops.com.